Like to caution listeners that the upcoming interview touches upon various topics that some may find upsetting. In an effort to tell the real story of what's now happening in Myanmar, we encourage our guests to share as they feel comfortable doing, affirming that this platform is one that could bear the weight of their story. As traumatic as the events have obviously been for our guest, they can affect even those of us listening from a distance as well. I'll be honest, every member of our team has shed a tear at some point or another in the process of bringing these interviews to you. And similarly, you might find yourself affected by this story. If you feel that some of this content may be upsetting in what follows, maybe consider listening in stages or whatever works for you. But please listen. Please bear witness to what this guest has to say. On this episode of Insight Myanmar Podcast, we're very pleased to be joined by Dr. K. So, Dr. K, thank you for taking the time to come and talk to us.
Yeah, thank you so much also inviting me.
So, you are a medic on the revolutionary side, supporting the resistance, supporting those caught by the violence, as well as overseeing trainings and supporting others in the resistance to learn how to give medical attention. This is quite a story in and of itself, but your story goes beyond just simply being a medic, because your background is Rohingya. You're from Mrau. Yeah. After Mrau, you spent time in Yangon, and so, you know, who you are and what your background is and what you're doing now, it's really quite remarkable, and that's where it's just so important and great that we get a chance to sit down with you and learn about that. As we do with many of our guests, before we get into what it is you're doing now, we really want to know about where you come from and your background. And so, as you said, your family's from Mrau in Rakhine State, and then later went to Yangon. Can you talk about those early years growing up and your medical training?
Mm-hmm. I just lived in there for maybe 3 years. And then after my 3 years of age, me and my family moved to the Yangon by the underground route, so because we can't go to the official route. So, and then...
What is that underground route? Can you tell us more about that?
I mean that to avoid the check station and the police checks and military checks, something like that. So we have to take some motorbike. I think maybe at that time I'm really young, so I didn't remember all the things.
Sure.
But what my eyes is like, what I remember is like, I have been a boat, and me and my brother, my older brother, and then my mom, three of us came through that boat, and then I think we have to walk a jungle route. We have to cross some, we call it Yakai Roma, kind of Rumah Mountain or something like so, and then that kind of, you know, an official route.
And so just to clarify for those listeners that might not have caught the deeper context, when you talk about the underground route, this is because as a Rohingya living in Rakhine State, the Myanmar state legally and literally prohibited you from leaving that area. So for you to leave Rakhine State, you could not do so legally as someone from Rohingya background, and you needed to find an underground way to be able to get access to Yangon. Is that right?
It's kind of like that, and it is not just only in the past time, you know. It is still in the present time.
Yeah, of
So
course.
now, if a Rohingya from the Rakhine State want to move from that area, they also need to take that kind of route.
Right, of course. So this is describing the present reality, but not just the present reality. This is something that stretches all the way back to your childhood and even years before that, this kind of prohibition based on ethnic and religious background. Yeah. So then you grew up in Yangon. Yeah.
So I joined the business, you know, the education program from the nursery to the grade 12 in Yangon, and then because of my mark in the matriculation exam, so I got the entrance of the medical profession.
And did those at the school and your peers, did they know that you were Rohingya?
Not really, because at that time there's so much, not even on the Rohingya, even on the, you know, being a Muslim is really a bit difficult. So I think I might hide all the time that
Really?
I'm a Rohingya.
Wow.
But when the 2015, after the election, so the media and some kind of transparency and the media knowledge is very good at that time. So the people in Myanmar know about the Rohingya people, and then it is a bit comfortable to tell the people like that I'm a Rohingya. It's after the 2015 election.
So before 2015, if you could not tell people that you were Rohingya or perhaps even Muslim, how did you describe your background when you were asked?
Mostly we tell like I'm a Kamen. You know, Kamen is the official ethnic in the constitution. So mostly we tell like I'm a Kamen. Because most of the people in our area know that we are not from the Yangon, so we have to tell that we are come from the Rakhine State, but like introducing us like a Kamen ethnic.
So you didn't have to hide that you were Muslim, but you had to hide you were Rohingya. Yeah, right. And were there at times suspicions and people wanting to investigate if you actually were Rohingya?
Not that much, because people in that time do not know much about the Rohingya. So they just know the Bengali or the people from Rakhine doesn't, so they don't know the what is the Rohingya and things like that.
I imagine, though, that this effort of having to hide your identity, that it's not just something you do one time. You know, it's something you have to think about what food you eat, what language you speak, what references you make, what your home looks like, your decorations, your dress. I mean, so much that goes into an identity. It's not that you just have one conversation and say, oh, I'm Kamen, I'm not Rohingya. So it's a whole subterfuge that you have to put on to be able to mask who you really are. Can you talk about what you had to go through with that and really the psychological burden that that caused?
In my memory, it's like there's no much of pressure and no much, not much of, you know, trauma on that things, because when I arrive in the Yangon, it's like I'm just 3 years old, so I didn't know the past memory of the life in the Rakhine State. So it is not difficult for me to change the culture and the way of living people in the Dutch area. So it's not much trauma on my memory. Especially for my parents, my mother and father, they have to adjust and they have to hide some of the, their culture and their dress and their language. So they have to hide on so much people. But there are a few Rohingya peoples at that time, at that, I mean the maybe 2001 or two. So at that time, it's like a few Rohingya in our area, our township. Whenever they meet with their friends from the Rohingya background in their area, they have to be very free. And whenever they go to their workplace and the bazaar, or even they have to come to my school for the admission or something like that, they have to hide. They have to hide their background, and they have to very careful the pronunciation of the Burmese language. Sometimes the people can recognize by the accent of the Burmese speaking, so they have to be very careful on that things.
I mean, this is all shades of 1930s Nazi Germany and Jewish people that as the reins started to tighten around them. And they started to have more exclusions and more danger, and lack of freedoms and discrimination against identity. I mean, all these things are bringing up those historical backgrounds. And then you mentioned how in 2015 with the election and NLD, you started to feel, okay, now we can maybe ease into who we are and our identity. Of course, 2 years later, you have the atrocities, the ethnic cleansing, the genocide, the mass exodus into the Cox's Bazaar, and so, it's really another thing altogether. So talk about those years between 2015 and 17, and also from your standpoint as a Rohingya living in Yangon.
So at 2015, after the election, so some of the sector in the media and then the some of the rule of the restriction that the people from the Rakhine to visit or to go to the other place for the maybe the medical checkup or something like that, it is a little bit easier after the 2015.
I see.
So at that time, I think some of my relatives also come to the Yangon because it is the great chance for them to live that really close area. I mean, the close area is like that because they don't have the full right to learn the education. They don't have full right to work. They don't have, they have to work in the other field for getting money or something like that. So after 2015, and the way to leave the Rakhine to the other state is a little bit easier. So some of the people move the Yangon. But the problem is that it start from the 2017, the ethnic cleansing of the Rohingya people. At that time, the people in the Yangon and the other who live in the other city rather than the Rakhine State, they also got a feeling of fear living in that place also, because people might know they are the Rohingya or the some of the people already know they are the Rohingya. So they're afraid of they have to they have to discriminate by the things happen in the Rakhine State. So they really feel about that.
So
That's interesting. There was a loosening after 2015 of being able to do things that people in your community couldn't do before. But then 2017 was a different story altogether. And did you or your family personally start to feel at risk in Yangon with your background and your identity and with people who might know that?
I think maybe we are the family. We already came to Yangon back in, you know, maybe around 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. So we have a very, very good connection with the people in that area. And then we are very, look like, you know, the Rangoon people. So we have that much, we don't have that much afraid of them. But what we saw is like the newcomer of Rohingya, I mean, the maybe who came after the 2015 or before the 2015. Mm-hmm. So this seems like a really unique, I mean, a very, you know, different with the people in who already live in the Yangon. So they have the feeling of risk about that.
But, you know, you talk about how Rohingya communities are having their opportunities cut off, all opportunities of every kind we can imagine, business, travel, medical, education, etc. And through your good marks, you have been able to become a doctor in the Burmese system, having done so only by hiding your actual identity, which if your identity was known, then those opportunities would be closed to you. So did you ever have any fear as you were going through medical training and licensure as being a doctor that if you were outed, so to speak, that your credentials and opportunities would be taken away from you personally?
Yeah. When I passed the grade 12, so because of the when I know that the my marks in the grade 12, so I feel very happy about that. But when they are the time that we have to admit the university, we have to go for the admission to the university. So the main problem is like, I don't have the birth certificate because when I was born in the Rakhine State, they don't have that kind of process in that area for the Rohingya people. Mm-hmm. So I don't have no birth certificate. Mm-hmm. I don't have any vaccination, no BCG or something, you know. Some people can recognize by looking that they are BCG vaccination. So the most afraid thing is that when you go for the admission at the university, you have to show them the birth certificate and the identity card. We have to show the family certificate also. So I have national identity card, family certificate, because we have to deal with the office person to give that national identity and the family certificate. We have to give some amount of money, you know. It's like a kind of not in really official way, because they are not. Yeah. It is not possible to get the national identity to the Rohingya people.
Right.
So we have to lie them, I am Khmer people, my mother and father are Khmer people, something like that. So, but the problem is my birth certificate. Mm. Because of I don't have the birth certificate, I have a feeling afraid to, like, I can't join the medical university, because if they ask for the, where is your birth certificate?
So how did you handle that?
Luckily, I think at that time, because of the, it is around 2013, so people are not very much oppressing on the Muslim people. So it is at that time, it is a very lucky to me to join the medical profession, because they don't ask that birth certificate, they just check the national identity.
So you didn't have to somehow fabricate or access a birth certificate, that you were just able to skip over that step?
Yeah.
I see, right. Yeah. So you had the official documentation in place partly because they didn't check one thing, and other things with a corrupt system, you're able to find a way to get by. So that's the legal part of it. But what about the informal part, that you're going to get an accusation from someone saying, oh, he's Rohingya, I'm sure of it, and that you're going to have to face some kind of informal accusation that's going to derail you?
Mm-hmm. So even I got the admission to the university, but I have to still hide that I'm a Rohingya, mm-hmm. because I think 2013 is like, it is very fresh that the seven Muslim people was killed in the Tangkob of the Rakhine State. Mm-hmm. Maybe you heard about it. So it is very close to that years. So people are mostly the people are very hateful in the Muslim who live in the Rakhine State. Even the Muslim who live in the Burmese, the Yangon was different than the Rakhine State. So they have a bit of hateful on the Rohingya people. So at that time also, I have to hide that I'm a Rohingya people.
Mm-hmm. Right. That must have been pretty hard on you personally, I would imagine, at that time.
Yeah.
Yeah. How did you manage? How did you deal with it?
It is just the only one solution is like I'm a common people. At that time, it's like I have a guilty feeling in my mind, because whenever they ask for the race, I have to tell them I'm a common. Mm-hmm. Because whenever I have to say that, my guilty feeling is appear that I have to lie them. I can tell them I'm a Rohingya. Mm-hmm.
And so how did you reconcile those internal feelings? I mean, did it, and what did it result in? Did you have a sense of anger, a sense of shame, a sense of confusion? What, having to be one thing and say another, what was your internal reality and internal landscape like as a result?
Yeah. So before my adult year, mm. It is not much feeling on my mind. Whenever I have to lie down, yeah. I'm a common. It is very lightly feeling, you know,
yeah.
Because I'm not not full conscious or something. Mm. But after my adult age, so whenever I have to say that I'm a common, it is very shameful in my mind.
Mm.
Yeah.
Mm. You know, I, as you're saying this, I'm recalling a similar experience I had, nowhere near the level of discrimination you had, but my background is Jewish. I'm not religiously Jewish in any way. It's a culture, it's an ethnicity. In my life growing up, it never really meant much to me. I experienced some degree of anti-Semitism in the U.S., but nothing too serious. But then I went to Morocco for 2 months on a school internship. And I was completely unprepared for the level of anti-Semitism and Jew hating that was prevalent among everyone, many people I met. And I would have, I developed friendships that some weeks or months into the friendship, a comment would slip about the worldwide Jewish conspiracy or how you can't trust Jews. Obviously, you know, I'm half Jewish, so my name doesn't reflect that background. So I had the advantage, or you could say disadvantage, of being able to hide my identity. And in some cowardly ways, I did. In some cowardly ways, I leaned into not having to identify as Jewish. And that never really was a problem in the U.S. Beyond, you know, some people that were just very anti-Semitic here or there, but not as a culture.
Yeah.
But in Morocco, and then I was told by the director of the school, when I spoke to him, I was advised outright, yeah, you probably shouldn't tell people that you are. So my identity never really meant anything to me until I was in a position where people that were liking me may hate me if they knew who I really was.
Yeah, yeah.
And that created, and that completely changed forever, actually, the way I looked at my identity afterwards. And it also made it really painful and challenging to know who my real friends were, because I had gotten so used to deception in my time in Morocco that I really didn't know, you know, which of the people around me would still be friends with me once I revealed what my background really was.
Yeah.
And it was, I had never been in that situation before. It was just for those couple months, it was really traumatic. And later, you know, years later, I was in touch with some of those people, and there were some people I said, you know, by the way, I never said this, but, you know, because out of fear, but this is my background. And those Moroccans said, oh my God, I'm so sorry. It doesn't change a thing. But, you know, one of the really painful experiences I had was I became friends with a fruit seller that was outside where I lived. And he spoke French and Moroccan Arabic. And so I was kind of practicing I'd studied French in college. And so I was trying to get, he was my conversation partner and remembering how to speak and understand French. And then also I was learning Moroccan Arabic. So he was conversing with that. We'd spend, you know, every day we'd spend an hour, you know, or so just kind of talking, hanging out. As I was leaving, he gave me his address and said, you know, make sure to keep in touch and, you know, write me letters and we'll go back and forth. And I said, yeah, you know, really, really nice. The last thing he said to me, this was at the time of the 2003 Iraq war. The last thing he said to me, and there was a lot of, in the Muslim world at that time, there was a lot of anger towards George W. Bush at his, at what he was doing in the Middle East. And you just hear this all the time then. But what he said to me as I was leaving is he said, you know, if you actually really look at George W. Bush and you look at his nose, actually, I think there's some Jewish blood in him. And that kind of explains why he's doing what he's doing. And my heart just dropped. Mm-hmm. I was just this guy I'd spent months with. My heart just dropped hearing that. And, you know, so I walked home, tore up the address, threw it away, you know, went on. And I'm going into a bit of detail about, you know, this personal pain
yeah.
I experienced in a very limited form in an anti-Semitic society. And so, and just the struggle, you know, to this day, the struggles I had with the deception, in some ways, my own cowardice, you know, the shame, the anger, all these things that bubbled up from not being able to be who I was.
Right.
So I'm wondering if, from this story I shared, if there was anything similar in your experience of, you know, this is your home. This was just a visit for me. I've never been back to Morocco. I won't go back to Morocco. But this is your home. It's the only home you have. So as you were struggling and dealing with this, was there anything similar that was boiling in you?
Yeah. So yeah, it is very the same feeling to me through the so many years, you know. But the most of my friends in the university life, even they know, I think I haven't tell so many friends that I'm Rohingya, but I do tell a few friends, even they are the Buddhist or the other religion. So because of the so much close on friendship things, I can tell them like who is Rohingya, how are they, what is their religion, what is their culture, what are they doing in the Rakhine state, what are the suppression and really restriction to that people. So some of my few of my friends who are very close to me, they really understand the feeling and the life of the Rohingya. So it is my maybe the lucky time that I have met that kind of friends.
Was it scary to make the decision to trust them?
Not scary, but it takes time to tell them that the true life.
Were they surprised?
I think, but they do not show that you know, the strange or the surprise feeling on their face.
And how did it feel for you when you were able to share who you really were and feel that trust? How did that feel to be able to express that?
When I was trying to tell them that kind of things, at first I'm afraid.
Really?
Yeah, because they're gonna accept it or they're gonna, you know.
Yeah.
Counter back to me.
Mm-hmm.
I have afraid feeling that, but after telling them a bit, you know, I can't tell the whole things about the Rohingya people. I have to tell them a bit, and I check their feeling and their
yeah.
expression.
Right.
How do they express? How do they feel when I am when I was telling that much?
Mm-hmm.
So, by checking that kind of thing, I have to tell them a bit, just by a day, you know, not all that thing in a full day. Yeah.
Because they've been so conditioned with hatred and fear.
Yeah, because they have a preformed, you know, that the preformed knowledge or preformed idea on the Rohingya people, but who told in the media. Mm-hmm. So they just know the people, the Rohingya people in the media. They don't know the real people in front of them.
That's right. And I mean, that's what I was referring to before, of you get to this place of, you know, who can I trust with the secret of my identity, and how much can I trust them, and how much do I want to talk and feel allies, and how much do I need to protect myself and keep it in? But then I have these, it develops into these internal complexes of these things I'm holding.
Yeah.
So your solution was to parcel out information slowly, check the expressions, the facial features, the comments back, not say too much at a time, and then see how far you could go with individual people.
Mm-hmm. Along with the data and the information of the Rohingya to them, the other important one is also I have to live, you know, I have to show them I am a good person. Not a person they know in the mm-hmm. media,
mm-hmm.
not the Rohingya who they know in the media.
Yeah,
I have to, you know, very careful on the so much things.
That's a lot of pressure and burden.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, in the United States, this is something African Americans, Black Americans, talk about, express their challenges of certain harmful African American stereotypes. That they have to, that there's so much pressure on them to model a different kind of, to show that they're a different kind of person. They almost don't have the freedom to be human sometimes and to have faults and flaws. They're so worried that their faults and flaws will fit into these harmful stereotypes.
Yeah, it's really the same. I have a bit used to of that, that kind of living, you know, because I'm not trying to live in that way, just only the university life. I have to, you know, live in from the whole start of my education career. So it's not really a new thing for me, because I have very good at it in from the early year of my life.
But the challenge with that as well is then it could overcompensate of someone thinking, oh no, Dr. K, he's great. He's not like those other Rohingya.
Yeah.
You know, this guy's great. He's not like those other blacks. He's not like those other Jews. He's great. There could be a challenge of overcompensating with that reaction.
Yeah. I think it depends on the knowledge that I gain from the real life, you know, the knowledge that I gain from the very the admired people of mine, and then I think it may be some of it may be from the book what I read, so I have to always careful about my personality.
Right. So then let's move your story along, getting in the years up to the coup. We'll talk about post-2021 in a moment, but pre-2021, it sounds like you continued to be pretty careful with who you revealed your identity to up to 2021. Is that right?
Yeah. I have finished my medical university at 2019, and then I have to join the internship. We call it like a... house sergeant. In Burma we call it house sergeant. So it's a kind of internship program in the hospital. So I have to join 1 year of house sergeant, and then but very bad luck is after finishing my house internship in at the end of the 2020, and then there is a coup in 1 month later. So before coup is at that time is a COVID COVID year. So what our Ministry of Health, what they did is like every medical profession, I mean, whoever passed the health internship, they have to join the government service.
Mm.
So some of my friends, they don't, you know, I mean, they joined the government service after the 2021. For me, it's like I have my family. I have to take care of my family. And my family mean my mother and father, and also at that time I have my daughter who is 1 year old. So I have to very think about my financial rather than the military government service. So I can't join to the government service. So I have to hide very, you know, low profile of the opening my clinic,
mm-hmm.
and working in the private hospital.
Mm.
So yeah, I have to pass that way.
So you do open a clinic and you keep a low profile.
Yeah.
What type of practice were you doing, and who were your patients? Who were mainly those patients that were coming to your clinic?
So I'm a general practitioner,
mm.
and also the medical officer in the private hospital.
Mm.
Yeah. So I did as a medical officer from 9 to 4. And then after 4, I came to my clinic, and then 4 to 9 as a general practitioner.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's a tough schedule.
Yeah.
6 days a week? 7 days a week?
7 days a week.
Wow. That's tough.
But after opening my clinic for 1 year, I close 1 day in a week. So
yeah.
I work for 6 days in a week after 1 year of practicing. Mm.
So the coup happens in 2021, and walk us through what happens next after you.
Because of I was living in the low profile, and I didn't register my clinic to the Ministry of Health, so they don't have any information about me. So maybe they think like I'm running the other business, not doing the medical profession. But the 2023, there was my brother-in-law wedding in Bangkok. So because of his request, and because he's very close to me, even my brother-in-law, so I think I should go to that wedding. So I was trying to leave from the airport. And then I was arrested in the airport.
Oh no.
Yeah.
What on what grounds were you arrested?
Because I didn't join the government service. I don't have to, I can't hold the passport. I can't leave the country.
Mm.
So they have the, you know, the software system in their immigration software. Like when they write my national identity number, this just appeared that the person is the CDM doctor, so they have to detain me. It is February 2024.
Okay, so we're jumping forward. So from 2021 to 2024, you're remaining in Yangon.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. And what were you doing? Were you just continuing to operate quietly?
Yeah, I just run in my clinic, and then I opened a pharmacy at 2023. Mm. So that's... That year is my, I think, my business years, maybe.
Mm. Were you involved in those years or immediately after the coup in any kind of revolutionary or resistance activity?
Mm. Yeah, I support some of the medicine and the other logistic things to the revolutionary side. Mm.
Mm. So mainly just providing medicine?
Yeah, medicine and... helping about the medicine logistic.
But mostly at that time focusing on your career.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. So 2024, you're arrested, and I guess your life takes a different turn. What happens then?
So they was detained me, and then they detained me for one day, and they asked so many questions from my born of the 1992 and till that time, you know. Uh-huh. It's a long question.
Yeah.
And I think they check my background. Maybe they have the same kind of data in their field, so they check that, and then they check my phone, my car, all of the data that they can. Mm-hmm. And then maybe they will see like I do not have any connection with the revolutionary side, so they release me. But they have to inform the, you know, the military in the township that I live, you know. They have to refer my information, like the person was detained in the airport. He is a CDM doctor, so the military in the township have to check him, check their home, check his home, check his clinic. So the person, the authority person from my township, they came to my home. No, they didn't came to my clinic at that time, but they do came to my home, and they checked some of my book and something, and they asked some question to my parents, like what he is doing right now, something like that. That's it. And then the other day they called me that I have to come to the office, so they forced me to sign that I will join the military government service.
Really?
Yeah. Mm. So you know, they asked me some amount of money, you know, but not in official way. That something like that, they have a meeting in the office, so I have to give the dinner fees or something like that. So, and then they call me frequent time and told me that, hey, are you joining the service or not yet? Something like that. So it is very happening frequently, so it is very pressure for me, so I have to leave here. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that must have been really scary to be on their radar like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Was that a hard decision to leave?
Yeah, it is really, really, really a very hard decision for me, because at that time I have my son who is just, I think, 8 months. My daughter is on nursery, so my business and my income is very good.
Yeah,
good at time. So it is very difficult to lose all of the team, all of this thing, you know.
But the risk was that by staying, the loss would be even greater.
Yeah, the risk is, you know, they can do whatever they want. They can take all of the money that I have try for so many years just in one day, so it is not safe to live there. I think 2024 March, the detained at the airport is 2024 February. So 2024 March, I have to leave the jungle. So I have to find a private car who can deal with the checkpoint throughout the routes from the Yangon to the Miao Ri. So who can deal with the checkpoint person, that because I can show my national identity card to the person in the checkpoint. Because when they check my ID card in their software system, the thing that I am a CDM doctor will appear again.
I see.
Yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So I have to find that kind of good private car driver And it took me one day to come mess up from not mess up to Miaoli from the Yangon.
And you were able to avoid checkpoints?
Yeah.
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 That must have been a scary trip. You were with your family or just yourself?
Yeah, with my family.
Yeah.
Yeah. My wife and my kid didn't want to stay apart from me, so they will join with me. So when I arrive at Miaoli, so I can cross from the official bridge. So I have to cross the Taurian River. It's just like an underway route. When I arrive in Mesao, my brother-in-law live in Bangkok. So yeah, he came to the Mesao and just wait at the Mesao that we will come. So when we arrive here, he is very take care of us. I think so many things, you know. He had so many things for like staying in Mesao, like to get a house, because we do not have any document. So he have to show his passport and his document to the house owner. When I arrive here, the first thing what I do is like my daughter education. So I have to look for which school is best for her. And then I have to try to get expenses that happen in my family. So for very 3 or 4 months, I do not have any job or any income. So I have to depend on the money that I was saved in Yangon. So after 4 or 5 months, I got a part-time job. And then I see how private work I can do in Mesao, like money exchange. So I do some kind of money exchange. And then my pharmacy is still in the Yangon, but it is just run in the garage, you know, not in the shop.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I have a few income from my pharmacy.
Right. Did you eventually get work?
Here?
Yeah.
Just part-time work. Yeah. Most of our time is, you know, on the volunteering work. So me and Dr. Sunshine is like doing a lot of volunteering things on the medical background and then also on the revolutionary side.
So Dr. Sunshine is another Yangon doctor who has been involved in setting up clinics and doing medical training on both sides. And so how did you make contact with Dr. Sunshine, and how did you then come to work together?
Oh, so Dr. Sunshine is to tell about Dr. Sunshine, I have to tell about my wife and my brother-in-law, because my wife, my brother-in-law, and Dr. Sunshine is in the same university.
Oh, okay, right, yeah. Right.
So they are all doctors. So well, the first time I meet with Dr. Sunshine is like, I think it is in their university. Yeah. So when I came to the Mesao, Dr. Sunshine is also in Bangkok, yeah, because he also got like a requesting letter to join the military service. So they have to also flee. He have to also flee to the Thailand. So because of my wife and my brother-in-law, we all meet again in Mesao.
So you meet an old friend, both doctors, and you're in Mesao. You're looking at the state of the revolution and resistance. And I presume you start to then talk, well, what can we do? What can we do from here? How did that conversation go?
We have already the medical background, so the thing that we can do is just medical things. Also, so we met with some some people who already live in the Mesao. So maybe some people just came to the missile after 2021 coup. Mm-hmm. So some people who live in maybe the 10 years ago. So we meet with different people, and then we got the idea what we can do, how we should do. Mm-hmm. So from that, we start step by step. Mm-hmm. So it is right now is 1.5 years that we arrive in Mesal. Mm-hmm. So, but the thing we can support and we can share our medical profession to different people is very wide now, because there are a lot of migrant and refugee community in the Mesal. So that most of them, they do not have document, so they can easily go to the clinic, they can get enough healthcare. So we have to start with that community. So we start with seeing that community, and then one day and 1 or 2 days in a week, so seeing the patient and giving some treatment. Yeah. And then the other day we met with the other NGO and foundation here. So we gave some kind of medical training, like first aid or visit her education training to the different organization, just as a volunteer, not in, you know, not in salary or something like that. Yeah, they happy a lot, because it is not possible to get that kind of service to them without us, you know. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because they can stay in just one area. They can go from here to another, even it is within the mesa. Mm. Because
go ahead.
Yeah, because they do not have a document.
Mm-hmm. Right. So this is the work you start doing in Mesa, but then you're in Dr. Sunshine's activity expands beyond Mesot, and you go back into Burma, back into the resistance areas near the front line with resistance groups, PDF groups, civilian IDP camps that are being harmed by the violence. This is a whole different type of engagement. So yeah. Talk about this part.
Yeah. So to go back to the Myanmar side and do this thing is like we got some request and the connection from the people who live in Mesal. So because the revolutionary side is they have to, you know, stay two group in the within the Burmese side and the Bora side, because they need some kinds of food and the other support from the borderline side. So mm-hmm. we meet with the people who live in the Mesal. So they request us, and they want us to give the training and do the medical service in the revolutionary area, and also the camp and so many different places.
What was it like to cross back over into Burma?
Whenever we cross, that we arrive in Burma side again, it feels like it is home. Mm. And feels very happy that we can do for our country.
Yeah.
Even we have to come to the Thailand.
I can have some sense of what you mean. I mean, just being in Mesot, and you know, there are official boarding crossings, but then there's such a wide border here that sometimes you just see a little bit of water that's separating. Other times there's no water. There's almost just a gate where you put your foot in and you're in Burma. And, you know, the pictures I took and showing friends, this is Burma right here. And just the feeling of proximity, sometimes seeing people, businesses on that other side wearing lungis, you know, walking around, it just, as one friend commented back, it's so close yet so far, and just having it right there so close, you know, the feeling it brought in me, it was quite powerful. So I can imagine for you, when you're actually stepping over the border and you're engaged in those on the resistance side, I imagine that first time must have really been something special.
Yeah. So we feel like we are not useless person, you know. Even we arrive and we have to flee our country and have to come the other country, so we are still the value person.
How about the danger aspect? To what degree did you have fears of going near a conflict zone, near a front line, and where did the courage come from to be able to put yourself in harm's way?
So whenever we go near the front line, we do afraid of the aircraft and the RPG or something. But what we got our courage is like by seeing the very young soldier in the Revolutionary Army. So we have a lot of fear about the war things because we are not very used to with that. But when you see that kind of soldier, there's no fear about
really?
It. Yeah.
Really?
Because they are really young and they are not using their knowledge. They are not using their strength. They are using their life. You know? It is we value them the thing that we are using, like the thing that we support in, because we are just supporting our knowledge. Mm-hmm. They risk their life for the country, so we are not nothing in front of them. Yeah.
I mean, that's a very humble response, but it's very heartwarming as well. I wonder also if you can, you've been to the front line, you've been to the red zone, the yellow zone. For many of our listeners, they've never had any experience of what it's like to be in a conflict zone, what it feels like, what the context is. So I'd like to prompt you to take us on an immersive trip into and describe to our listeners the first time and the subsequent times that you were at or near the front line and what it feels like and what you're seeing when you're there.
So the front line that we are going is like not the first line zone. It is, I think, second or third line. Uh-huh. Because we can have the soldier in fighting. Mostly what we do is like giving the training to the medic soldier. So it is maybe second or third line. But we hear most of the, you know, the battle sound in the ear. So yeah, it feels very afraid whenever you hear about the gun sound and then the aircraft, you know. The most afraid one is the aircraft.
Really?
Yeah. Mm.
How many times have you been around airstrikes?
I think whenever you go that area, you will hear the aircraft.
Does that fear, do you ever get used to that fear, or is it just as terrifying every time?
I think right now it's a bit used to, but still having afraid because we have to find that safe place whenever you hear that sound.
Is there a safe place?
I mean the cover area, just a cover, maybe the bomb or something like that. Yeah.
So when you hear those sounds, I assume everyone, civilian population, children, elderly, fighters, medics, anyone who's anyone, they just get used to, you hear that sound and you know what to do then, and you wait till it passes and hope you're safe.
So I mean, what used to is like maybe we all used to with that sound, but not a feeling of safe.
Sure.
With a feeling of afraid. Used to with a feeling of afraid. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because we are very, super in recognizing the aircraft sound.
Yeah. When you hear aircraft when you're back in Thailand, do you have a similar response?
Mm, yeah. Yeah. I think. But it is not much like the real soldier. You know, whenever the real soldier from the revolutionary side, they came to the mess out, mm-hmm. It is very strengthening for them. Mm. Yeah.
I bet, because that sound can mean the difference between life and death.
Yeah.
When you hear it, when you first hear it, detecting the different range of that sound to tell what kind of danger you're in as it's changing.
Yeah.
So your mind must be so attuned and conditioned and trained to be able to listen so specifically to it that you can't just turn that off when you get somewhere else.
Yeah. We all have automatic response on the aircraft.
Yeah. So you're not on the front line. You're on the kind of the second or third layer because you're not fighting. You're training and you're providing medical units for those that are on the front lines and have to be rushed back. So then take us to that experience. What do these clinics look like? How do you set up? And then what happens in terms of treatment when people are rushed to you? And what kinds of things are you treating?
The clinic is just a, you know, the bamboo room, just a bamboo with some leaf as a roof. So we can tell it is a clinic because the common patient is like the. I think the injury patients and other malaria is very, very common. And then the other gastritis problem and urinary stone because of the diet they have, you know, the water they have, it is very, very much in calcium. So there are a lot of urinary stone patients and gastritis patient because they can choose their lunch and dinner, so they have to eat the what they see in front of their eyes. So that kind of patient and a lot of injury patient.
So what you say, they have to eat what they see in front of them. So what is it that they're eating that's causing these issues?
Very hard rice and the. Not a very fresh meat and fresh things, and also some of the fruits and some of the vegetables are really, you know, ripened. Yeah, so because of not the fresh food and meat, yeah.
When you set up these medical units just on the second line, when there's an active front, what kind of activity are you seeing? Are these set up for hours, for days? Do you have many people coming you're having to triage and work on at once, or is it spread out or scattered? What is that like?
So at that second line is like, there are some doctors who stay in the front line. So the most of the major and the life-threatening condition is treated in the first line.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So and then that patient are sent back to the second line. So at the second line, I think we have to do the bleeding compensation and then the treating of the hypovolemic shock or something like that, and then also the suturing. Yeah, so most of the patient is that things, yeah.
So when you say they're brought back to you, those, the life-saving support is on the front line, those that need the secondary support are brought back to your stations. When you say brought back, are we to assume these are like porters that are carrying them across village tracks to those clinics?
Yeah. They have, I think, they prepare the truck for the injured soldier, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And in terms of the materials that you need and the medical facilities, I mean makeshift medical facilities, are you able to get adequate supplies for what you need for those purposes?
Not adequate, you know. It is. Sometimes we have to do the minor surgery, the thing that you see, you know. Maybe sometimes we need that size of the suture or that size of the dressing material, but you won't have it. So you have to adjust the thing with the thing that you have. Yeah.
So I just want to give a shout out for those listeners that there is an opportunity here to do more than listen, to support. We will have information in our show notes about how you can support the work that Dr. K and Dr. Sunshine and others are doing to get this much needed medicine. And we also invite those listeners to write us directly on, you can find our email from the website. If you do have more inquiries about how you would like to give and how you would like to support, we can talk to you about ways to facilitate, to provide, to be able to help provide life-saving medicine that, as we've just heard, is not enough. So I want to make sure that listeners just have a moment to understand that there is a place there you could step in. I also would like to ask you, Dr. K, you know, you mentioned you don't come from a combat medicine background. You're a general practitioner.
Yeah.
You know, what you do as a general practitioner in an urban middle class setting is extremely different from going into an active conflict zone, setting up a temporary clinic where you're dealing with life and death emergency situations of those that have been injured in fighting. So what was that transition like for you?
There's a few different in the combat medicine and the internal medicine, So I have to see the other combat medical background person, like Dr. Sunshine. So, and then I have to read the combat medicine that I get from my friends, So I have to learn a few.
So that's kind of the technical side of how you had to develop. What about the emotional, the psychological, that side of it, and the trauma that you must experience from this, because you're putting yourself in a situation very different from the general practitioner stage. Was it a hard adjustment for you personally?
Not hard for my body, but I think it is very hard for my mind, because it is really a stressful zone, Whenever you see an injured patient, it is not a very good condition. So it is very, very stressful and also very sad feeling in mind whenever you see a patient, injured patient. So I have to try to pass that time of feeling. Then when you are staying in that near the conflict zone and near the war zone, that kind of very stressful feeling is not appear in that time, because there's no time to feel about it. There's so many people, so it is just very consuming of time very fast, But when you come back to the missile, the other side, the feeling is start to appear at that time. So you will be very sad, and I think I want to live alone whenever I come back to the result again, because there are so many things in my mind. So I can't tell, and even I don't have courage to tell about that things to the other people. I just went to silence, and I just went to live alone at that time.
But you're with your family?
Yeah.
Yeah. My family. Is that hard to...
Very, very hard.
Really?
The kids are trying to... the kids went to play, and I have so many things to do for my family, like going market, and family matter is so many different things.
Yeah. And it's like you've lost a part of yourself.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I can imagine. What do you do to cope?
My personal time is at night when my kids and my family sleep. So I'm trying to get my own time at night. Mostly maybe I see a movie what I like, and I listen to the sound that I like, and I read the book that I like. for movies, like I like classical movie, you know, so the movie likes Forrest Gump, Catch Me If You Can. So I like Tom Hanks and Robin Williams movie. Godfather. So whenever I'm trying to see a movie, I read a script in the Google, because I don't have so many time to see a different, so many movie, you know. Yeah. So I make sure that the movie that I see is have to be the way I like. So that's why I have to read the script in the Google, and then if it is my kind, then I watch. The movie, like classical movie, like, you know, Forrest Gump, I think it is biography. Mostly the biography based on true story movie. Mm. Yeah.
Mm. Great. Yeah. You mentioned that when you come back from the other side, you know, when you're in the middle of it, you don't have everything move so quickly. There's no, to be able to be effective, you have to compartmentalize. You have to push everything away to get the job done. But then when you come back on this side, everything comes back up. Your mind is full of all this stuff. I don't want to trigger anything or re-traumatize, but if there's any, if you feel comfortable, if it is something you can talk about, just for the benefit of our listeners, be able to come closer to understanding what this conflict is all about and what is actually going on. I wonder if some of those things that are heavy in your mind that are replaying, if there's some of that background or specifics that you might be able to tell, as long as you feel safe and it's not re-traumatizing you.
Yeah. I think they are not very few to tell about, you know, because there are so many things that are happening in front of my eye. So the main one is, whenever you hear the one soldier who are really enough close to me when we give the training, or we see the patient and we stay in the second line, whenever you hear about that person is, you know, lost. Mm-hmm. So at that time it's very stressful and very sad moment. And then the other side, mm-hmm. Mostly are not patient, most are our student, or, you know, I don't know how to tell and how to express it.
So another part of your experience is, as we talked about at the beginning of the interview, coming from a marginalized, discriminated background. And, you know, we talked in such length about how you were not able to reveal your true identity for so many years. And so in this last year in Mesat, have you been, to what degree have you been open about your Rohingya background?
I think, There are a very amount of Rohingya people in the Mesa who stay in very years ago, and who came just a few months ago. So I have a little bit of safe feeling to tell about that I'm a Rohingya in Thailand, because the Thailand people they don't have so many, not much discrimination on Muslim. So yeah, I feel a bit safe to tell about it.
But among the Burmese community in Mesat and Chiang Mai, over on the other side, the resistance fighters you're working with, are you completely open with your background of Rohingya, or do you still have some limits in place and safety mm-hmm. safeguards?
Most of the people from the revolutionary side, they have a very wide mind. So it is very, I don't have a penny of afraid feeling to tell about I'm a Rohingya to that
really?
People. Yeah.
So this is incredible. I mean, so for the first time in your life, you're, correct me if I'm wrong, but it sounds like for the first time in your life, yeah, you're able to be in Burmese and specifically Bamar communities and without fear talk about your Rohingya background. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely.
How does that feel?
It's very, you know, it's like a 100, I'm 100% human, you know. because I don't need to hide anything of my background, my personality. So the people from the revolutionary side who live in here is like, I think they now know the feeling of discrimination. So whenever I'm trying to speak about the Rohingya, they already have the same feeling because they have a discrimination from the military. So yeah, it is not difficult for me.
Yeah, I mean, that's just an incredible transformation and development in your story that this all this time we spent talking about, you know, obviously the whole, the atrocities, the genocide that happened to the Rohingya people is one awful, tragic thing, goes without saying, but your personal story of how you had to struggle with those identity issues in the only place you know is home, and to you know, one silver lining of however bad this whole thing has been, but one silver lining has been that you're able to be who you are among this group and to be fully integrated in that, to be whole, to be human, in your words. It's just incredible.
Yeah. I think, it is because I am I give my time and my energy to this revolutionary side. If I'm not that person, I don't have enough confidence to tell about I'm a Rohingya. Because right now it's like I'm giving so many time, my energy, my knowledge to this one group. So they will see how value I am for them. That's why I do not have zero of afraid feeling to tell about that I'm Rohingya. Mm. Even I do have a proud feeling to tell them I'm Rohingya because I'm not the ordinary person to them.
That's awesome. That's incredible. You must have had some pretty amazing encounters and conversations along the way.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah, right. So as we're continuing talking to bring our listeners in on the context of this conversation, we're this entire time, as we've been talking, we've actually been joined by Dr. Sunshine, who's been in the room and listening and able to jump in if needed, but there's been no need for that because this conversation has been going along just fine, and you ultimately did not have anything to fear about with your English. You've been able to express everything you've wanted to say, but I think it is a good point. We've done a separate podcast conversation with Dr. Sunshine, but I think it is this gives us a unique opportunity to be able to check in. And you know, often when we're talking to a person, they're describing everything from their first person perspective and experience. But there is an outside view that person's not able to express. So this gives us a unique opportunity to jump in with Dr. Sunshine and have us, you know, fill in any gaps you want to say, give any commentary, or just give us an outside perspective of your colleague and friend that maybe hasn't come out through this conversation.
I think like Dr. K, he's a very humble like human being, first of all, and him like just being more out in the open, saying like, okay, yeah, he's a Rohingya, and then he's like helping all these people, and the way that like there's just zero discrimination among like everyone, and not just him, like within the PDF soldiers, like we have already seen like Muslims, and not just Muslims, like we talked like in the previous like section, we had like LGBT, we have like female, we have like kids, but the thing is that we don't need to hide who we are anymore also, which is like very, really, like really, really good for everyone involved. And even like him as a person, like I can see him like grow so much just within the past like year and a half of being in like Mesot, actually. Like it changes like totally.
How have you seen him grow?
He's become more like happy. He's become more happier. Because the first few months, like, I was really, really stressed about what to do with his kids, like, especially like his daughter and his like son, who are like family to me also. Know them like since they were born. So like at first was like really, really stressed. Every day he's just like, okay, I don't know what to do with my like daughter, right? Because even though like we weren't friends before, we like we know each other, but now that like we've come to Mesa, we have to like walk every day, we see each other like every day. Sometimes his like wife is jealous because I spend more time with him. So with like, and if like if I have problems back home, right, I don't have like people to talk to, I'll talk to him. And if like if he have problems, he'll talk to me. With like we confide in like each other. So, and from that, like, I know, like, he had, like, troubles, like, with, okay, what should I do with my daughter? Like, oh, what can I do with my kids, like, education and stuff? How can I keep my wife happy also? And, like, all these different things. And then, like, within the, like, past year, just from, like, helping other people, you get the, I would say, the fruit of helping other people. You just get, like, people help you back, and then... just to like help people, it makes you feel good, I think. And he's like way more happy. Like the kids are happy, the wife's happy. Yeah.
So yeah, that's amazing to hear. And Dr. K, to ask that question over to you to reflect on what was just said. You know, you spent the first several years keeping a low profile in Yangon, taking care of your family, having the business running, ran into danger, had to flee for your life, was in a new place, all of this stress. And then ultimately, you know, probably the material needs are not so taken care of as you would like, but the volunteering that you're doing in the sense of giving back, talk about how you have your friend and colleague talking about this transformation he sees in you. What are your thoughts on this transformation? Do you see this this shift in being more involved in this voluntary way towards the revolution? Has that really made some kind of shift or transformation inside yourself?
Yeah, I think it is the helping of the other people, you know, it is a kind of road to the road to your personal improvement also. Yeah, because helping to other people, you get trust from the other people by seeing this person is doing this thing, this person is really trustful or something like that, you know. Because I have to express that I am a trustful also. So by helping the other people, I got some road to my personal improvement also for the good of my family.
So Dr. Sunshine also said that you seem personally, you seem a lot happier.
Yeah.
Is that true?
Yeah. The first 5 or 6 months of my 2024, when I arrived in Mesa, is really a very struggle time for me.
Are you happy now?
Yeah.
Right. So another part of the story is just looking at the inter-ethnic harmony, and we hear so much about inter-ethnic tensions, and I think that's different with the young generation. You know, you're a Bamar Buddhist and Rohingya colleagues that are doing this work together. You're going into ethnic areas where you have all these youth kids, as you keep saying, that are coming from, you know, largely Bamar, but also Muslims and many other backgrounds. They're in ethnic areas, so you're working with largely, you know, Karen administered area. So there's a lot of diversity just in this segment. So, you know, when you look at the potential future of the country in a post-military Myanmar, and as we read all of these outside observers, you know, giving this kind of pessimistic analysis about the potential cooperation of these different EAOs and, you know, the inter-ethnic relations that have always plagued Myanmar history. Dr. Sunshine, how do you see this little microcosm of what you're doing here as being relevant for looking at these future questions?
I think like even not in the revolution area, even like in let's say in military-controlled area, there's still a lot of like support now for like everything. In the past, what like the military would use was like propagandas against like Muslims or like just like different ethnicities, right? They would do that. But now like the military tried to do that, especially like in Yangon and stuff, like they would like come up with propagandas like framing like Muslims or like framing like Buddhist and like Muslim areas. But people have already started like seeing through it, mm-hmm. which has like really, really helped a lot. Like you would see like even in Rakhine, there were like cases where, you know, like the military would like pretend as like, how would I say, like the Rakhine people, and then they would like attack like the Muslim areas, or they would like pretend as Muslims and then like attack like Rakhine areas, like propagandas. But now, because of the coup, which I would say like is a good thing out of the bad stuff, like people have started seeing the true like nature. Okay, like, oh, this is all just like propagandas. I mean, there are still people like who really, really are just really, really like close-minded, but because of it, like a lot of people have started seeing, like becoming more like open-minded. And now they started seeing, oh, okay, like Muslims aren't the bad people. It's the extremists that are the bad people. Mm-hmm. Or like, it's the propaganda like behind it. That's just like, even if we fight right now, it's just like if we fight over food, mm-hmm. or if we fight over like a friend or something, it'll just be like friends fighting. But how they would put it in the like propaganda before, mm-hmm. it's like, oh, okay, a Muslim and a Buddhist started fighting, mm-hmm. like that's how like the media like and the, like the military propaganda is, mm-hmm. but the good thing is people started like seeing more about it, and they started like becoming more open to it. They started seeing like a lot more, so I think we have a bright future later on, like with more like people becoming like more open to like different ethnicities, different religions. I think we still do, like we really do have a like bright future.
So I don't know how much you follow like international news or analysis or opinions, because this is a hot topic among anyone who's following Myanmar, but to whatever extent you do follow some of those articles and opinions that are coming out, do you feel that there's something missing on the ground, a perspective not being taken into consideration that you guys are really living examples of?
Like, also a lot of the people also like try to like exaggerate stuff, and
true.
Like sometimes on ground it's not too bad. Like sometimes they're thinking like, oh, okay, yeah, like the killings are really bad. It is really bad, but like the people on ground, like sometimes like what they think is like, okay, they feel really bad, they exaggerate it, and I like, feel really bad for people on ground, but we're doing just fine. Like we support each other, we're there for each other. And the funny thing is like when we're inside, like in the jungle, right, where you are surrounded by kids, if you talk about it, all of them are feeling bad for the people in the city, which is like funny in a way, because they are feeling bad for the people in the city. Like they, what they always say is like, okay, yeah, I feel really bad like for the people in the city, they're stuck there. Right now we're not scared anymore, because right now there's like, okay, there's bombings, there's airstrikes, but we're not scared for our lives. We feel bad for the people inside, because every like day to day, right, you're scared of like, you don't know when you're being like going to be drafted, you don't know when you'll get shot, like when you don't know when you'll get like checked, and then if they check you, if they don't like something, they'll just like beat you up or something. You don't know that. They feel bad for them. And yeah, but like people here, I think like the kids have just become like, what they want is like, oh, don't feel bad for us, we don't need you to feel bad for us, but like support us.
I think like if we're gonna win, if we get a chance to win, and also the get a chance to run a government from the people, from the revolutionary side, it will be very change of this conflict in the minority things and the discrimination things. So many things will move to the good side. Yeah.
And what does it mean to you also? You know, I asked you a moment ago how you feel personally that you can be so comfortable being whole, being human, sharing your background and identity. But the other part of this is, what does it mean for your community, and what does it mean for your family? You know, what does it mean that your son and daughter can, maybe this is happening now, but certainly when looking at a post-Myanmar military, that they could go to school with classmates that are Bamar and Christian and Rakhine and Kachin and all these others. And I'm kind of remembering Martin Luther King's phrase right here, that, you know, black and white children can play together, and that the color of the skin will not determine the quality of their character. And that was the kind of post-racial America that he wanted to see. What is it, as a parent and as having a young son and daughter, what does it mean to you to think about the fact that there could be a day, what you're working towards right now, that there could be a day where your children can be in school and be fully open and honest and transparent with their identity, be respected for who they are, to be able to interact with people of very different identities, to form friendships, bonds, have opportunities open, and to bring Martin Luther King Jr.'s words into it, to be judged by the merit of their character and not their background, color of their skin, religion, ethnicity. Has that been something you've thought about?
Yeah. Being a father is like, my goal is like, I will try my best to get my kids their life being a very, balanced, like without the discrimination, without stress or so many things. Like, yeah. So, if the our country Myanmar is changed, I mean the government is changed, the age of my kids, I mean the future, the age of my kids will be a very very good than the age of us, you know. But if it is with this government, this military government, the thing will be very worse. Because the data is like it is the hand tool for them, like the discrimination and the anger within the different community. You know, if there is a anger and discrimination within a different community, it is a kind of tool for the military to run their power. So if it is with this military government, I think there is no safe place for my kids. So, yeah.
That's incredible. So the work that you're doing is tangibly, literally, directly trying to build this better future for your children.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I thank you so much for taking time and joining us and sharing your story. There's been so much in here that's been really wonderful to get a chance to hear and inspiring as well.
I wish right now is also the many international organizations and many international people are very helping to our revolutionary resistance thing. So yeah, so just continue supporting us and wish us to get a good country for our future generation. Yeah.
Many listeners know that in addition to offering these podcast episodes, we also run a nonprofit, Better Burma, which carries out humanitarian projects across Myanmar. While we regularly post about the current needs and proposals, we also have to handle emergency requests at times, often in matters that are quite literally life or death. When these urgent requests come in, funds are often needed within just hours, so there's no time really to conduct targeted fundraisers. For these situations, we try and maintain an emergency fund. So please consider specifically helping us to maintain this emergency fund. we want to stress that a donation of literally any amount allows us to respond more flexibly and effectively when disaster strikes. Discover how to donate at betterburma.org/donation.
Yarananga yaunya na da du ya dananga di ganeza de mana we gara besa yana besa yo ho ba yarananda da yarananga na yarananya da yarananga poda ba yarananga.